Hello, this is Mark Seidenberg. I am recording a new version of a talk that I gave on December 4th, 2023, at Yale University. This is the same talk as I gave then, but I've added a little material because I don't have the same time constraints as I did then. I hope that it'll be helpful to people. The talk is called Where Does the Science of Reading Go From Here? I'm a researcher who studied reading and language and dyslexia for a number of years. Over the past several years, I've emphasized looking at ways that we could improve literacy outcomes by using basic research in these areas. That would be via changes in teacher education, classroom practices, instructional materials, people's attitudes and awareness. I try to maintain a focus on learners from minority and lower income backgrounds for whom needs are greatest. But low achievement isn't limited to any one group, and it's certainly a broad concern. Connecting research and practice is an obvious idea. Much is known about skilled reading, relations between reading and speech, learning to read, the brain bases of reading, the causes of reading impairments, and these kinds of issues have been studied in many different writing systems and languages. You compare that with an obvious need to improve outcomes. There are many indicators of this. There are assessments such as the NAEP and PISA and state assessments. And of course, everyone's aware of the gaps that exist between higher achieving and lower achieving groups. So you put these two things together and you get the science of reading. I should point out here that the science of reading doesn't mean the same thing to researchers and educators. For researchers, it's a body of research. This is a recent volume that has chapters summarizing extensive research on many topics. For educators, the science of reading is a little different. It's an approach to reading instruction and teacher education. It's reflected in science of reading laws in more than 30 states, which stipulate things like the use of curricula that are consistent with the science of reading, instruction consistent with the science of reading, and in-service teacher professional development about this. There are new curricula and guides to instruction. There are new professional organizations and enterprises, all of which are elements of this science of reading approach. Just as a side note, the chapters in the Science of Reading volume, which was published in 2022, review cognitive, developmental, and neurobiological research on many topics. The research that's taken as foundational in the science of reading approach in education is either not mentioned at all in this volume, which is things like the reading rote, or mentioned in passing as the historic precursor to modern work. The science of reading movement in education is an important development. It's been successful already in largely dislodging the whole language balanced literacy approach. This has opened the door to change. And I think it's really important to recognize that from the start. Where it's still a work in progress is incorporating research-based principles and practices. This has been a concern of mine for some time. At present, the science of reading approach is based on a small number of concepts taken from a few simple and dated studies, which are being used to justify a variety of classroom practices, including ones that aren't supported by research. So the general gist of this part of the message is that we need more science in the science of reading. Okay, well, what does this talk about? This is an important moment in attempts to reform reading education. I think it's important to examine what's being taught under the science of reading rubric and to resist the creation of new dogma and to not squander a really remarkable opportunity. Here's some recent history. In 2017, I published a book. It had a lot of chapters about how reading works, and it had three about the disconnection between research on reading and education. And it did effectively point out the need for change. Emily Hanford's podcast brought concerns about how reading is taught to a much, much larger audience. There's some irony in that a story about how reading is taught really reached a large audience via this auditory medium. Still, it was enormously successful in raising awareness of the issues and generating concern and a demand for change. There's been quite a lot of other media coverage since. This is just a little of it. There was a third important development. There was my book, there was Hanford's podcasts. There was also the creation of advocacy groups such as Decoding Dyslexia. It's a national organization with branches in every state, in many states. Decoding Dyslexia reflects the fact that parents of dyslexics were angry at the lack of responsiveness from education, and they organized. They focused on legislative remedies at the state level, things like screening for children at risk of dyslexia, language impairments, and they're demanding the provision of appropriate instruction. So a science of reading movement emerged. And you know, we can tell there's a science of reading movement because there's merch, which I love. It's just great. It really reflects people's enthusiasm about adopting a research-based approach to reading instruction. So this looks like great news. Science wins. And it is pretty amazing given the antipathy to science elsewhere in the culture. Here we have thousands of teachers and other educators who want to know more about research, which is great. This is progress, but there's a hitch. Identifying what was wrong with reading education turns out to be a lot easier than figuring out what to do instead. Kind of a typical situation, right? Easier to say what's wrong. Then you have to figure out what to do that's better. It's particularly difficult because of this disconnection between education and science that I wrote about. So we were successful in generating a huge amount of interest in reading research and a demand for change, but it's hard to get the research into the system given the lack of background in among educators and among people interested in education. It's also a problem, I think, that there aren't that many scientists who really engaged with these issues. In my view, the science of reading laws were a necessary evil. They were necessary because other attempts to reform reading education had failed. People had tried and had been brushed off. But you know, mandating something via legislation doesn't make it happen. Some people may recall that No Child Left Behind legislation actually mandated that all fourth grade children would read at grade level by 2014. These laws stipulate that an instruction and curricula be consistent with the science of reading. What science are we talking about? Who decides? It's something that we need to look at. So let's back up for a moment and look at what the science of reading is replacing. thankfully. Well, the whole language balanced literacy approach, what were the major assumptions? Well, the main ones were these. The assumption about phonology was that it was relevant for poor readers, not skilled readers. It was assumed that word reading was dependent on the context in which the word occurred, something that researchers call sophisticated guessing. Basically, this is the view that Ken Goodman promoted, and it's reflected in the three queuing method and related sorts of methods. The assumptions about learning were basically that learning to read could be made to be like learning a first language. If you have a literacy-rich environment and the children are highly motivated, they will absorb the mechanics of reading without a huge amount of instruction. So the role of instruction then is guided discovery. Kids going to figure it out with some assistance from an instructor. The problem with these assumptions, of course, is they weren't right. Reading depends on spoken language. Phonological information is crucial to skilled reading. It's not just something for poor readers. Linking print and sound understanding is an enormous, important first step in learning to read. Child needs to grasp the alphabetic principle, which is that units in spelling correspond to units in the pronunciations of words. And of course, it's important that they learn spelling sound mappings, which involve phonological information. Contextual guessing is an inefficient, error-prone approach to teaching someone to read. That's why I said that the most reliable cue to a word is the word itself, not the context in which it occurs. Learning to read isn't like learning a first language in the sense that the child has to be taught that there is this thing reading and that there is a code and that it works in a certain way. You don't have to teach, an infant that there's this thing, spoken language. So reading does involve explicit instruction in a way that learning a first language, spoken language, does not. So those assumptions weren't right. Why did people accept so much that was wrong? Because they were vulnerable. They were teachers and others rely on experts who weren't reliable informants. And they didn't have the background to independently assess mistaken claims. Those would be things like Richard Allington saying that dyslexia didn't exist, it was only an excuse for poor teaching. Or Ken Goodman saying that good readers only sample the words in texts, they only read some of them, which is just blatantly empirically wrong. Who could tell that these people were saying things that were false? Okay, well, we've got the science of reading approach. What are its major assumptions? Well, science of reading is taking a variety of forms, but I think there are a few major strands to it at this point. One of them, of course, is that learning to read isn't like learning a first spoken language. Phil Goff wrote an article in which he said it was an unnatural act compared to learning a spoken language. The idea was that explicit instruction was required and that it wouldn't just happen naturally like learning a first spoken language. There's an emphasis on print, so I think this follows from the simple view of reading from Goff and Tunmer and Goff and other colleagues. What people tend to say about this is that the child already knows spoken language, which is true, and the first task is to learn how print represents it. So there's a lot of emphasis on how to teach kids about print. Phonemic awareness turns out to be a foundational concept here. It's supposed to be a basic enabling skill. This is based on the National Reading Panel report. So we have the idea that there are 44 phonemes in spoken English that children should learn to identify these phonemes in the dark, meaning without print, because they are units of spoken language. And the tasks that are favored for teaching and assessing phonemic awareness are tasks like phoneme deletion and phoneme substitution. There are a number of major figures here. There's the Kilpatrick materials, the Hagerty curricula, and this is also emphasized in letters. There's the idea that reading skill is something that you build up by components. So there's a lot of discussion about components of language and components of reading. So you can start with the phonemes, then you could talk about the graphemes, then you could get into the correspondences between them, which is phonics, syllables, morphemes, vocabulary. Fluency is like a pot, and we're going to add ingredients one after another. Finally, there's this idea that you can't really have too much of a good thing. So I think people recognize that some learners don't need all of this explicit instruction, but there's the view that this isn't going to be harmful in any case. So at worst, a kid might get additional practice with essential skills. It's like, getting additional practice with your tennis serve or something. I would say this is a leave no stone unturned kind of approach. There's the idea that if these various components of reading are taught, then no child will be left behind. And for the ones who don't need all the explicit instruction, it's okay. It's just additional practice. Those aren't all the assumptions, but I think they're the major ones. Well, we should look at them. Are they valid? And the answer is yes and no. So learning to read is not like learning a first language. It's an unnatural act. Explicit instructions required. Yes, but there is another kind of learning. It's called implicit learning. The important point here is that most of the knowledge that supports reading isn't learned via explicit instruction. There must be another way to learn because we aren't taught all these things. So a good, obvious, straightforward example of that is vocabulary. People know thousands of words. Even young children know a couple thousand words. And very few of them were ever taught. They were picked up some other way. Same is true about spelling, phonics, morphology, many other things that we're talking about here. Most of it isn't ever taught, and yet it's learned. The emphasis on print, yes, print is important, obviously. But developmentally, the thing that has the biggest impact on children's progress, by far, is their language background. Oh, and some of the pioneering work here was done by Hollis Scarborough, whose Reading Rote people know. I think this work really deserves to be as well known as that. So language development before the child is taught to read has a huge impact on their progress with reading. Indeed, most reading problems aren't about print. Print isn't the problem. It's the knowledge of language on which print depends. So a simple view of reading might be emphasizing print when we also need to be emphasizing language development at least as much. Phonemic awareness as a foundational enabling skill, learning the 44 phonemes. I think this is where the one place where the science of reading has really gone off the rails. I don't think it's an accurate interpretation of the research literature. Phonemic awareness is the result of becoming a skilled reader, not the precursor. Of course, it is associated with skilled reading. It's something that develops in the course of learning to read. Phonemes aren't literal units of articulation. They are abstractions. They don't have correct pronunciations to teach children. People are really into phonemes. I make fun of the, merchandise here, but it does reflect people's enormous enthusiasm for certain ideas. And it pains me to observe that this might be based on a misinterpretation of the research literature. Something we have to look at. How did the science of reading settle on teaching phonemes first? I think this is a little digression about phonemes. How did we get to the idea that you teach the phonemes first and then that's the thing that enables learning about print and print sound relations and so on? It might have come from several places. One is clearly a National Reading Panel report, which said, you know, phonemic awareness is a teachable component of reading. And I think some people hearing about this, perhaps secondhand, took it to imply that, well, if phonemic awareness is associated with skilled reading, teach the phonemes. That's not actually what the National Reading Panel review showed. It isn't a review of studies showing that teaching phonemes leads to more rapid reading acquisition or higher levels of reading skills. In fact, there's a long discussion of phonemic awareness in the National Reading Panel report, and their conclusion about the relevance of phonemic awareness derived from studies of phonics and other activities that paired print and sound. That's where the phonemic awareness arises. The decision to teach phonemes first as elements of spoken language is an extra assumption. It's not derived from research. It wasn't in the National Reading Panel period around 2000, and it's not. There isn't any research showing that learning the phonemes first is important now either. It's a poor decision because it treats phonemes as pronounceable elements of words rather than abstractions. You know, phonemes are a way to think about language. They're not actually things you say. My reading of the research literature is that teaching phonemes as units of speech using tasks like, you know, deciding if two words start with the same sound or not, what it does is it improves performance on those tasks. So, you know, if you teach kids to do phoneme matching or phoneme identification using spoken words, their performance on those tasks improve. But the question is whether that activity and that learning carries over to reading. And there, I think the literature is pretty clear that it doesn't. It certainly doesn't provide strong evidence that it carries over. And I would say the reason it doesn't easily carry over to reading is because it's not actually time spent teaching the kid to read. It's teaching them to perform this kind of artificial phonemic pronunciation identification tests. In contrast, there's lots of research showing that teaching phonics and other kinds of activities where you pair the spellings with pronunciations, that does carry over to reading performance. And I'd say the reason it carries over is because it's time spent teaching the kid to read. It's reading aloud, but it's reading. Okay, so at this point, we should take a deep breath because this story about phonemes is probably not what you wanted to hear. If it isn't what you wanted to hear, don't panic. So teaching phonemes to kids without print isn't damaging anyone. You know, I see a lot of enthusiasm about teaching phonemic awareness. And it's truly, it is amazing to see teachers getting so into this, which is, after all, basic skills instruction, something that for a long time people were told wasn't important. And, you know, just the fact that teachers in the classroom are so energized about teaching phonemes, that itself could have an impact on children's progress in reading. You know, I'm not in the classroom and I don't think that relevant studies have been done. But it could be that that kind of enthusiasm and those kinds of activities have an impact on engagement and the kids' receptiveness to other kinds of instruction that are actually more relevant, like phonics. You know, you could have some progress there as a byproduct, some benefits as a byproduct, not because you're literally teaching the phonemes and or because that's important to reading. So, I find when I critique these practices that don't have a solid research foundation, even a plausible one in this case, some people respond by going, "Oh my, I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm a bad teacher." And that's not my message. We are all trying to arrive at best practices and the most efficient and effective use of time. In my view, looking at the research, what it means, what these concepts actually mean, things like phonemes or phonemic awareness, being more effective and efficient is going to mean spending less time on phonemes and more on things that are closer to reading and have a bigger impact, like phonics and language. We don't know for certain whether teaching phonemes is effective or ineffective. We just don't have that kind of outcome research. And I think it's important to recognize that just focusing on basic skills instruction is a big advance over what came before. But that doesn't mean we have to keep doing the same thing just because we started in that direction. We might have to back off and take a somewhat different direction. I have one suggestion here, which is that instead of phonemic awareness, people focus on the alphabetic principle. So the alphabetic principle is developed by Isabel and Alvin Liberman, Donald Schenkweiler, and a number of other people from Haskins Laboratories. The Reading Rockets website entry is good, and I would recommend reading it. So the alphabetic principle is referring to the idea that the child is learning to treat units in the written code as corresponding to units in the spoken code. That's the big connection that they're making. And in the beginning, it's graphemes, which are letters or combinations of letters like TH, and phonemes are the connection that they're making. And as I've laid out in other talks that are on this website, learning about graphemes and phonemes is interactive. They go back and forth with each one influencing the other. Developmentally, the child then starts building larger units, such as rhymes. So this phrasing, alphabetic principle, makes it harder to overlook the role of orthography in shaping phonology. And it is the theoretical basis for all the subsequent investigations of phonemic awareness. So I'd really encourage people to think, look, you're trying to get the kid to start behaving in accordance with this alphabetic principle. It's somehow instruction has to lead the child into being able to treat units in spelling as corresponding to units in phonology. And the units in phonology are themselves emerging in part because of their exposure to spelling. I think that would probably be helpful. Okay, so that's the end of my digression about phonemic awareness. So we were talking about the assumptions of the science of reading approach and the idea that they're kind of right, but not entirely. We're up to the one that's building reading skill by components. It's like adding bricks to a structure. First you get the phonemes, then you get the graphemes, and so on. I think this is really overlooking a couple of important things. It's not making use of the fact that all these kinds of information are related to one another. They're not independent. So when you're learning about one, you can also be learning about the others because they're correlated. They are related. And in cognitive psychology and developmental psychology, there's this idea of bootstrapping, where you get a little bit of information about one, and then it provides you with a clue about something that's correlated with it. You learn about spelling, it tells you something about phonology, phonology tells you about spelling, and they kind of go back and forth, bootstrapping each other. I think the other problem with the brick by brick kind of approach is that it really can wind up being focused much more on the components of reading instead of reading itself. I've certainly observed this in some situations where there's so much time allocated to the components that people don't get, that the kids don't get opportunities to read with feedback. I've driven, I, this is a, these are drawings that I've shown before. You know, there's teach the components approach is one in which you learn one kind of thing and then you learn the next one and then you learn the next one and so on. And I think that this is pretty much what's happening with the science of reading currently. And people are stipulating that the kid has to reach a certain level of performance on one type of information before they can move on to the next one. And then there's assessments and feedback and so on to figure out to get the kid to move stepwise through all these kinds of information. Now, the components in this approach are definitely based on research. Those are real things that are relevant to reading, but the decision to introduce them sequentially is not. That was an extra assumption that I don't think should go unexamined. One can contrast this with the view that this other figure is trying to convey, which is that these kinds of information are all related to one another. So when you're teaching about one, the lesson might be about phonemes, but you might also be teaching the kid, giving the kid opportunities to learn the words in which the phonemes occur. So when you're teaching one, you're carrying along this correlated information, giving kids additional opportunities to learn it. That's potentially a way to make instruction efficient. And this approach is based on research, not just about the types of knowledge, but also about how children learn. Finally, what about you can't have too much of a good thing? Of course you can. Of course you can. The clock is ticking. There's a lot to learn. Fourth grade is looming. So, in my view, the goal of basic skills instruction is to get in and get out so that you can move on to all the other things that go into comprehending texts of varying complexity and other things related to reading comprehension. To me, looking at it from the outside, the science of reading sort of structured literacy approach is pretty plodding. There are low expectations about the rate of progress. You know, I was pretty appalled to see that people might be doing phonemic awareness practice in third grade. And I would raise the question here, is this approach in its, you know, in the in not wanting to leave anyone behind? Is this approach inadvertently teaching, treating every child as though they might be dyslexic? And where's the fast track for people, for children who can do that? So I've suggested that some of it is right and some of it is really kind of off. How do people come to have these beliefs? Again, I think teachers and other people who are in on this movement are relying on experts who aren't scientists and who don't turn out to be reliable informants about research. And again, the audience is vulnerable because it's not part of their training. They don't have the expertise to evaluate the claims. Notice this is what happened the last time. Okay, well, where does the science of reading go next? I think, as before, it's easier to see what's wrong than to figure out what to do instead. We're all working on this, it's a work in progress. I wanted to end this talk with a few suggestions. This isn't a curriculum, obviously. It's just a set of research-based considerations about teaching children to read that are relevant to teaching effectively and efficiently. They are things you could take into account. All right, first one. Goal of reading instruction is reading. We want to keep our eyes on the prize. Instruction about the components of reading is only justified to the extent that they ex advance the main goal, which is reading. And this isn't a trick question here, you know, reading. What does it mean to advance reading? It means advance the kid's ability to read words and sentences and texts of varying complexity. There isn't any fixed requirement to learn a certain amount of the subcomponent. The requirement is that the kid gain skills in reading. So, eyes on learning to read, not teaching kids about the components of reading. Language development is really key here. Everything in reading depends on knowledge of spoken language. Children's knowledge of school English varies enormously for a variety of reasons, and this has huge effects on their progress in reading. One response to the fact that children are already falling behind in reading in kindergarten and first grade is to start reading instruction earlier in pre-K. And in fact, some of the science of reading laws stipulate that. But notice that just moving instruction back to pre-K isn't going to be effective if the issue that's the limiting factor is the kid's knowledge of spoken language. You want to think about the kid's spoken language being sufficiently developed to support learning to read. Again, it's not that the child has a language impairment. It's just things like they may speak a different language, or they may speak a dialect that is different from the one that's going to be needed in school. Children need more opportunities to talk and hear. Here's another one. The goal is to facilitate cracking the code, not teaching the code. The goal of instruction is for children to learn what there is to learn, that there is reading and that there is this code that has certain properties, how it works, and then gain enough basic facts to enable reading texts of increasing complexity with less and less reliance on external feedback. The child can crack the code, at which point much more of the learning can occur without direct feedback and instruction. Cracking the code is a much more manageable goal than trying to teach the kid all the phonics or all the rules for spelling words. What about explicit instruction? It's important, but it's there to scaffold this other kind of implicit or statistical learning. So this other kind of learning picks up on patterns that occur across utterances or across written sentences. So there are many patterns in how we talk, how texts are written. Those really are things that people's brains are very well attuned to picking up. And that's the engine behind learning things without explicit instruction. So you need an explicit instruction to scaffold this other kind of learning, not to teach at all. It's the alternative to teaching at all. So, you know, the science of reading has picked up the idea that everything has to be taught or else it won't be learned because, you know, reading is unnatural. It's not like spoken language. That's not exactly right. People have this other way of learning, and explicit instruction is slow. It's not necessary, and it is slow. It's inefficient. You know, there's opportunity costs, right? The more time you spend on one thing, the less time there is for other things. We want to have explicit instruction, which is costly in terms of time and effort. Be as focused as possible, and not more. I think it's really important to distinguish what teachers might need to know about reading and language and what children need to know. You know, I find people are very excited, teachers, educators are very excited when in their professional development they learn about properties of spoken and written language. Things like phonemes, syllable types, morphemes, the allomorphs of the past tense, digraphs, diphones, inflectional morphemes. Listen, I spent my life studying language and how people learn it and how it's used. And it's an amazingly complex and interesting, fascinating system. And I think people should know this. But it doesn't mean that the child has to be taught it. It's important for the teacher to understand how language works and how children learn to read. But it doesn't mean that you have to turn around and then teach the child all these things. It's important for an instructor to have information about language and about how children learn. But for the kid, it's all about doing it. So there should be some boundaries here, and I don't really see them being respected. I think people are enthusiastic about discovering all the cool stuff there is to know about morphology and types of phonemes and other things of that sort. It is really interesting. But people have to think about how much of that's relevant to the child actually getting where we want them to go in terms of comprehending and language and writing and so on. I just put in a reminder about instruction being equitable, meaning that it's effective for all children, including people who speak other dialects or other languages. Something that works for a speaker of sort of the general dialect of English that is used in books might be able to make use of certain kinds of instruction much better than kids who speak somewhat differently. It's something to be aware of and try to work with. It's important to take a developmental approach. What's relevant to teach changes over time. So, in sometimes in not obvious ways. So here's one. So initially, talking about kids who are getting into reading. Your knowledge of language, their knowledge of language derives from their experience with spoken language. That's how you learn about language when you're a little kid. With literacy, as the child begins to read, as an individual begins to read, their knowledge of language expands because they're exposed to words, expressions, grammatical structures, and so on. That occur much more often in books than they do in speech. So there's a learning curve here with a kind of changeover. First, it's the spoken language input to the child that really matters. What can they learn from the spoken language environment? But later, it's their reading experience that's going to advance their knowledge further. Here's another one. Components of reading and language, they are related. They are not independent. So treating learning to read as acquiring a series of subskills or components, I think it's popular because it corresponds to a natural scope and sequence. You teach one, then teach another one, and then another one. And you just have to monitor children's progress to determine where they have reached a certain level of performance or where they need more help. Well, that seems natural, but this step-by-step sort of approach isn't really doing justice to either how reading works and or how children learn. So the components aren't independent. When you learn about one, you can learn about others. And learning, children's learning, human learning, one of the ways that we learn is by picking up on relationships between different things. Correlation, you can call them correlations, you can call them overlap, similarities, connections between different things that are related. And I think it's easy to imagine how instruction can take advantage of this. So I've used the examples. Example where you're teaching something about how to pronounce a spelling pattern. like a complex onset or something like that. So the kids got the spelling and they're learning how to pronounce it. Well, at some point, that can be taught using words. So even though the lesson is trying to get the child to grasp the pronunciation of a consonant cluster, at the same time, they are getting exposed to words and are able to learn from those experiences. Could be learning more than one thing at a time, even if instruction is focused on a particular one particular thing. Here's another illustration of how to think about correlations between different types of knowledge rather than thinking of them as independent. So sometimes people think about language and topic knowledge as being these separate things that have to be addressed in learning to read. Well, learning to read does involve three things. It involves learning about print, involves learning about language, and it le involves learning about the world, which is the things that we use language to talk about. So basic skills instruction, is predicated on the fact that print and language are related. We're trying to help the kid make those connections because they're in the way the writing system works. So print and language are clearly related. What about language and knowledge of the world? Are those related? Oh, yes. So learning about a topic entails learning a new language. They're not independent, shouldn't be treated as such. There's a very amusing demonstration of this from Randall Munroe, who has a book called Thing Explainer, and you can get examples of it on his web cartoon, comic strip XKCD. So he did a funny thing. He asked whether you could explain interesting concepts using only the 1,000 most frequent words in English. So you're limited to 1,000 words. Can you explain complex concepts? Well, the answer is yes, but not very well. So, food heating radio boxes, that was the closest he could come to microwave ovens. Tall roads, that was the expression for bridges that. Again, if you're limited to the 1,000 most common words, that's as close to the concept of bridge as you can get. Planes with turning wings. Well, it's sort of a helicopter. Oxes that make clothes smell better, washer and dryer. What's the point here? The point is that when you learn about new things, you learn new language. So it's kind of setting up a false dichotomy to say that language and world knowledge are these different things, and part of the day you can study language, and part of the day you can study world knowledge. Child can be learning about both, clearly. Okay, so that's the assumptions. I think there and some of the tenets. I think it's pretty clear that we're going to need a bigger toolbox. The problem with just relying on the few sources here is that they leave a lot out. Things like learning, for example. And because there's so much left out, anybody can, everything is consistent with the science of reading at this point if this is all you're working with. And it is a bottleneck trying to get more of what we have learned into the system. It's not easy. It's not a question of, blaming people. It's hard, and we're still trying to figure this out. I think, people draw these pictures that really don't say very much, but convey as kind of pseudo rigor. Pictures like this one on the right really bother me a great deal. I think they imply all the wrong things. One thing is they imply you need to teach all this stuff, but you don't. There's a failure here to distinguish what the kid needs to know in order to read versus what a teacher might know in terms of background about how language and reading work. It doesn't make any sense to me at all, but this is the kind of thing that people rely on. And what I'm saying is we need to kind of raise the bar. So here's a summary. Using research on reading and related topics like learning to improve literacy outcomes is still a great idea. And there has been success in some areas. We also want to maintain the momentum. But ultimately, our instructional practices have to be effective. And in my view, the success of the science of reading endeavor isn't guaranteed because of the difficulties in getting much science into the system. What I see is people are adopting practices that are kind of loosely inspired by research, but actually not really very closely tied to it. And practices such as that heavy emphasis on explicit instruction, perhaps over heavy, I think they exist because people haven't adequately been able to take advantage of the research literature. Finally, relying on authorities is not a good plan. It's not a good plan in science, and it's not a good plan in the science of reading. Thank you for listening.